and television nerds, my name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Patrick McKenna. Patrick began his acting career with Toronto's famous Second City Theatre Company. Then he took to the road as a stand-up comedian, headlining universities and clubs throughout North America. Eventually, episodic television beckoned, first with a hilarious red-green show with 15 seasons as the lovable, nerdy techno-geek Harold, while simultaneously performing 5 seasons in the acclaimed dramatic series Traitors. Variety newspaper noted Mr. McKenna has made television history by being awarded Geminis for both the best performance by a lead actor in a comedic series and the best performance by a lead actor in a dramatic series in the same year on the same night. Currently, Patrick co-stars in 2 new hospital series, Hard Rock Medical for TVO and APTN, as well as Global Television's newest hit drama, Remedy. With any remaining free time, Patrick continues to guest star in several dramatic and comedic series, from Murdoch Mysteries to The Mercer Report, and has recently entered the world of cartoons, lending his voice to no less than 5 regular animated series. Next, you can see Patrick star in the soon-to-be-released feature films, A Masked Saint and Margarita. And now my conversation with Patrick McKenna. So I've spent the last couple of nights watching some of the people at TVO were nice enough to provide me with a couple of screeners of Hard Rock Medical Episode 1 and 2, which I know was just on the other night. I'll have to admit, Patrick, I didn't know the show existed before a couple of weeks ago. Maybe that's because of the fact that I don't watch enough TVO, but I don't even know that they do promos on TVO, but I really like this show. And I've since gone back and started watching Season 1. This has to be a unique experience. I don't recall the last time we have had an adult situation something. I don't know whether to call it comedy or drama that's been on TVO.
Yeah, no, actually, you know, they haven't done anything that's produced themselves that way in years and years and years. They do some kid programming.
Yeah,
but it was a real uphill battle to convince them that an adult show would work, because the director and producer Derek Diorio, he did a French version up in on TFO.
Right.
So he was up in Sudbury making these shows for TFO, and he was suddenly realizing, well, you know, this template should work in Ontario. There's no reason it wouldn't. So he went down there and chatted with them, and they just, you know, they really weren't into it. They, you know, we don't have that kind of money. We don't have that kind of time. It's not us. So he kept at them and kept showing them that it really wouldn't cost that much, you know, for the different ways they invest in things. And finally, they put their foot in the water and kind of took off. And because we shoot up in Sudbury, nobody's really looking over your shoulder, you know?
Right.
So you have that advantage of the isolation of, let's just shoot what we want to shoot the show. This is the show we want to make. And we kind of went at it that way. And they came in with notes and were great notes because of that. They know their audience and they know their demographic and all that kind of stuff. So they were really cool that way. And it was a kind of a nice marriage. It wasn't, after that, discussion was real smooth, you know, they were just on board. So it's been a really cool ride that way. And people, like you say, no, you didn't know it was there. There's not a lot of advertising TVO does outside of TVO. You know, so if you're not watching it, you're not going to hear about it.
I mean, it's been picked up on APTN too, which is great.
Yeah, yeah, that really helped.
That'll certainly help. And the fact that you've got a lot of the first season episodes up online and stuff like that. But yeah, even on TVO, they don't do a lot of other Canadian networks are laden with self-promotion of the shows they have on. TVO doesn't quite do that as much.
No. I think this might be one of those corners they turn where they start to see, because Hard Rock has caught on in a very weird way. Like you say, you see it and you kind of go, this is far more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, so it kind of unfolds nicely where people go, it's Canada. We're playing Sudbury for Sudbury. It's Canadian actors. You know, there's just a lot of homegrown stuff in there that really makes it accessible to TVO. So all those people who love TVO already, they're on board. Yeah. But it's starting to filter out a bit, nicely, because of the APTN marriage. That's a national market,
right.
You know. So suddenly it spreads out a little bit more, so we can draw people over to the website and things like that. The nice thing about TVO is really grassroots, and it's a show like this. And same when I was doing Red Green, you just kind of make the show, and the people who like it will find you, and it grows and it grows. If you don't work too hard on the product, other than what you want to do, make the people happy that are happy, and forget the rest who already made their decision. They don't like those type of programs or whatever.
Right.
You're never gonna catch those guys. So just keep making the show you want. And it's really impressive to watch an audience grow that way. Because I hear more people say, like yourself, of, you know, that was good. It surprises people, you know. That was Canada, and I like that. It was all right.
I didn't want to make it sound like I thought it was good because it was Canadian. I was just, it's because I hadn't heard of it that usually when there's something that's out there that's good, you expect that you're going to hear of it through channels. Considering I'm doing a podcast once every couple of weeks where we're talking about Canadian stuff, and it's not that no one had heard about it, it's just that it wasn't at the forefront of conversation. There was a couple of articles that were written here and there and stuff like that. But it just didn't have that kind of widespread appeal. Now, the fact that APTN has mandatory carriage, I think, is going to help a lot as well.
Right. Yeah, very much. Because it is really hard to get. Well, you know, you're in the media world. You know how difficult it is to kind of get everyone, are circling around your product, especially when you're up against American people and all the rest of the big shows and big names and all that kind of stuff. It's a real, you know, you're lucky if you got a good show and timing. You know, that you're able to get that stuff out there and people can hear about it. So that sometimes things fall in line and other times they don't. But this has been a really nice little ride watching it grow, that's for sure.
Now, I don't know what quite to classify this show as, which is probably a good thing. Because we were talking about it. We recorded a TVA podcast the other night, and we were all talking about the fact that, you know, I was going to be talking to you, and Greg David was talking to a couple of other people involved in the show. And we were talking about it's not quite a situation comedy because there's quite a bit of drama in this,
right?
And so we didn't quite know what to classify it as. I like to think of it as a situation serial. Because
that's a good description. Yeah.
Because there is kind of, you know, an episodic resolution usually at the end of each episode that I've seen, but really the character arcs are meant to be stretched out over the course of at least a season.
Absolutely. Yeah, there'll be a beginning, middle, and end for each character that way. You know, to a degree that you'd be satisfied, because again, Canadian TV, you never know if you're coming back next season.
Right.
So you kind of got to tie things up with some kind of resolution that people are satisfied with. But letting it float a bit that you could build on that if you needed to. You know, so that's been kind of nice. And technically, we started out as a drama because we have to have, you know, there's an educational component that you have to have for TVO.
Right.
And all those type of things that it was more of a drama. But once you get into that world of being a doctor up north, suddenly things that are actually quite, you know, serious, they look ridiculous.
Right.
But that's really part of the experience of being a doctor in the North, is that and that's why you have only certain people who can be doctors in the North. They have to be able to roll with that kind of environment and choices and realities of, you know, delivering a baby in a skidoo or working in the mine or people falling through ice and frost, like just different things that, you know, we can find a comical way. But it's what I love about the show is how we thread the education component in there through the drama versus talking about it or pointing a finger at it or having a big surgery scene.
Right.
We have it through the characters experiencing the people and the landscape. So it was a nice way just to let the incidences come to the students as opposed to us chasing the medical wagon.
Well, and it's a pretty huge cast. Which I found, like, when I looked at I saw the cast picture and I thought, oh, surely they're not going to be able to interweave all of those characters in 24-minute episodes. And you get a pretty good amount of a lot of characters having. I mean, it's a show that moves.
Yeah.
I mean, you go through, everyone gets served at least a little bit in every episode, and those character arcs kind of continue. That has to have been a challenge. You know, you're sitting down at the beginning of the season and thinking, how are we going to get all these people to get all their time in? And that's an incredible writing achievement to actually get that conveyed every 24 minutes.
Oh, it's incredible, because when I got on board, the producer, Derek Fiore, has been a friend of mine for 20-some years. So he was telling me about the show, and he's like, you know, you won't have to do much. It's really about the students. And I said, oh, you know, okay, that's fine. Whatever helps, that's all good. Mm-hmm. And then once you get there, you see 8 students, 4, there's 12 of us. You know, and that's, wow, okay. So we start pairing up and things like that and working in groups. But you're right, it's a very clever device that they find to put people in pairs at least and get them out and then work in a group, you know, so the group comes together and then they spread out. The group comes together, then they spread out. So you're right, you can at least see the cast and feel where they're going. And last year, I think we spent a little bit more time with Gina Tamara DeMarde on her storyline. And this year, it's a lot of Steph Paquette and myself and, you know, everyone's kind of getting a nice little ride out of this, of experiencing some depth into their character.
Now, is the TVO, shooting the schedule for the TVO, is it the same as you would experience on, you know, a private network, or is it a little bit different?
It's a little bit different. I mean, because for me, for instance, I went in the last 4 days and shot everything, because this year I most of my stuff was up in a cabin up in the mountains. So, you know, it's all about block shooting. So you kind of, the first day we all sat down, we read all 8 episodes. So everybody kind of understood where we were going with the show. and what your demands would be. So when you started block shooting, you were kind of prepared for what you needed to do and what scenes you'll be required to be outdoors, indoors, because it's Sudbury. You know, you get so many different types of weather. I mean, I don't know if you've never seen too much of the first season, but we were shooting late into the year.
Yeah.
So we'd have snow when you had camera on one side. And by the time we turned the cameras around, it was gone and sunny, you know. But we kind of went, oh, man, we're skunked. We can't do anything. But because it's Sudbury, that's really what happens in a day.
Yeah, for sure.
It'll be blistering snow and then it'll just stop. It'll be rain. And then it'll just stop. So it kind of worked for the environment of, we're not going to fight this. This is what's happening today. This is what's happening in this moment. And
it's the authenticity of continuity.
Yeah. And
that's the way it is.
When you don't have a budget to kind of go, let's match the snow on the other side with a machine, you know, that's not a choice. That's not an option. This is this is a very, 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 very tight budget that we're working on.
Yeah.
So everybody who's involved in the show, we all know that going in. So the quality has to be there for everybody to kind of go, yeah, I'm willing to sign up and put 8 weeks into this because I like the product and I trust it. Because the payback just isn't there in that sense of a regular program versus the network. It's just not applicable. But that's really not why anybody stays in Canada to be an actor anyway. So
yeah.
That's not too big of an issue. But it's the idea that everybody really trusts the show.
So right now, I think from what I understand, all the shooting is done and all the editing is done for the most part in season two as well, even though it's just starting up now.
Exactly. Yeah.
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 So I know the first couple episodes just rolled out, and I know that people can go on and watch them on the TVO website, which is great. We always encourage that. To me, a show like this, which we, like we said off the top, that doesn't necessarily have as much promotion behind it, it can only serve it well if people can go and marathon season one somewhere.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you can do that. I think it was at tvo.org / Hard Rock Med.
Yeah.
And you can see them all there. And because they're only 22 minutes each, they just fly along.
Yeah.
You know, I love the show that you've seen a lot and all of a sudden the credits come up and you go, that's it? That was a lot of information in 22 minutes, you know, because, you know, you, nothing against American shows, but you try and watch 2.5 Men, you kind of go, is it still going?
Yeah.
Is it still,
yeah.
You know? You're still on this thing? Okay.
But when you're dealing with as many characters as you've got, that helps it too.
It really does. The scenes are short and fast, you know, so, and from an acting point of view, you don't milk too many moments, you know, you get to the business of things because you know it'll get edited out if you don't anyway. So it makes the work very fast. You've got to know your lines and know what you're doing and be on top of it. And again, with that many people, it's a lot of trust. It's, you know, every day you say to everybody, look them in the eye and say, you ready? Because here we go.
Yeah.
We got, you know, sometimes you got 20 some pages to shoot in a day.
Well, it's nice to see that it seems like the writers were getting your character out to the burgeoning lumber sexual market out there.
Yes. Wasn't that different? Wasn't that different? And it even gets sexier, my friend.
But you're right. When I saw that the show was shot in Sudbury, I thought, wow. There's not many shows that you can say are shot in the home of the big nickel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, you know, selfishly, I'd never been up there really. So it's like, well, this is going to be a great experience just to get up there. And you know what? It's so much like Hamilton. It's incredible. You know, there's such a work ethic up there.
Oh, yeah.
That I just kind of got it. Everyone kept going, oh, man, Sudbury. It's like, nah, you know what? I kind of get this town. I like it. People work for a living and they party hard when they got the opportunity. And then it's right back to work. And I get this. I like it. And it's so different from what I expected visually, because everyone kept talking about it looks like the moon and all that sort of stuff and rock and hard.
Yeah.
They started planting trees like 30 years ago when all that stuff was happening.
Yeah.
And now it's all fruition. So it's a gorgeous city.
Yeah. I think we should work on the segue to Hamilton. But first, I think we're going to do a beverage update.
Oh, cool.
Beverage update for me is not that exciting today. However, I try to make it sound as exciting as possible. I have two drinks on the go. And they're very similar to what they were when I recorded a podcast the other night. I have the remains of a bottle of Diet Dr. Pepper sitting beside me. That is not too exciting.
Well,
it is not necessarily artisanally drawn from anywhere, except it is prescribed by a doctor, apparently. But I also do have Angel's Envy Bourbon, which is also sitting beside me. So I've got a little snort of that because I like to celebrate every time we have a discussion and, you know, that kind of thing. So,
That's good. That's a good choice.
I'm a bourbon drinker. So Angel's Envy is my choice. I've got, in addition to that, I've got about 50 or 60 bottles behind me in cabinets. I do like my bourbon, but that's the
choice. I too am a bourbon man.
Ah,
yes. But right now I'm enjoying a Cameron's coffee it's made of woods and water. It's the breakfast blend.
Oh, the breakfast blend.
Yes, it's because it's for me. I'm an actor, so every moment is a breakfast.
Yes, it's got eggs, bacon,
Oh, all those good flavors, exactly. Yes. Just a hint of brown toast. It's lovely.
Rendered lard.
And I went for the full 10-ounce version. That's what I did.
Yeah. New from Folgers, rendered lard.
Mm. Heart-stoppingly good.
Yeah, well, that's about it. So, a Hamilton guy. I instantly know that we've never met, but we get each other.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
There's something to be said about the fact that if I was to yell out Argos, you know exactly what I was talking about.
And I'm in Toronto.
Yeah, well,
I still know, and it's good.
I understand you have to play it that way. I get it.
Yeah, no, it's funny because when I lived out in Vancouver for a while, you know, and nobody is from Vancouver. Every time you bump into somebody, they're from somewhere else. But when you met someone from Hamilton, it was like easily the coolest sit down for anybody. It was just like, okay, this is weird, right? Vancouver, huh? Yeah. You could just start right from the beginning of it. Ain't Hamilton, man. It's a great town. I love that place.
The way that I always equate it is whenever I come back over the border from the U.S., there's always, even though I haven't felt tense, there's always part of me in my gut that just kind of relaxes a bit when I'm back in Canada.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally,
when you cross the border.
Yeah.
That further happens every time I come back into Hamilton.
Yeah. Yeah, growing up there, it's like it's always home. So anywhere I walk, even no matter how much the town tries to change, to me it's Hamilton. It's the people. Yeah. You know, they don't change. Yeah. They try and make the buildings different and this and that, you know, but it's always been downtown. It's been downtown, the north end, east is east. It's very cool that way. You kind of know what you're getting. You trust it. You know the people. I lived in pretty much every area of the town, too, by now. So it's all good. I feel comfortable wherever I go. It's just been great that way. My son was raised there for years. You know, my family's still back there now, my brothers, my mother, and so on. So it's the touchstone place.
Very, very cool. So I have to do a short list of landmarks.
Great.
Tally ho.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, right? Yeah.
The beef basket?
You know, that was more my wife's one. She was down there. All right, I'd gutsy when she's not here.
The Palace or the Casino Arcade?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even the Palace Theater. Do you remember that one at all?
Yeah. No, I'm a little bit younger, so I don't remember when it was a theater, but I remember hearing that it had been a theater.
Yeah, because I was just at that age when I was young that you could go to like the Palace, the Tivoli, the Century. Yeah. They were all down there in the really old theaters, and then they just started, you know, when they started to crumble, they all went, you know.
The Odeon 1 and 2.
Oh, yeah, that was fancy, man.
Yes.
Oh, that was fancy. And then years go by and it's gone, you know?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And the Highland, that was always down this. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Highland, I think, became a porno place for a while, I think, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, there was a couple. The Delta became a porno place, definitely.
Oh, was that one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, see, I'm pretending I don't know.
No, see, it's okay. It's good. It's good. It's all Hamilton stuff. It's all Hamilton stuff. It's all good.
You know, I still haven't been to the Nuke Stadium yet, though.
Oh, well, neither have I, to be honest with you, because really it's not done yet.
But
as Hamiltonians, we said, screw it. We're going to go to games there anyway. It's not done.
Yeah,
we'll survive. There's no toilets. Don't worry about it.
It doesn't have to look pretty for me to fight in. Yeah. I can fight when it's not ready. I'm good.
Yeah, there's no toilets. Screw it. The Argos are coming in. We're going down there. So pretty much all the early years in Hamilton, you got your start here?
Kind of. Not really. You know, it was odd because I got my start. I went to Westmount, you know, step there, and there was a great teacher. I was just bombing at school, and he took me and a buddy to see Second City in Toronto.
Right.
And that's when I knew what I wanted to do.
Right.
But I didn't really get a chance to do much in Hamilton because I was already getting a little older and kind of getting towards different things. I was with the Players Guild for like one show.
Okay.
And that's actually where I met my wife.
Okay.
So that's the only theater I did in Hamilton. I didn't really grow up doing any of that stuff. I was kind of a shy kid, but it was through there that kind of exploded. And then when we did Red Green, we shot in Hamilton for years at CH down there.
At the venerable CH Studios.
Yeah. You know, and growing up in Hamilton, it's like, hey, man, they did Tiny Talentine in here. This is cruel. This is where they did Party Game, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I was a guy growing up that Billy Van was like the king.
Hilarious, yeah, so, House of Frightenstein.
Right?
I'm just
so
saying.
So I thought, this is, yeah. And so you're walking around going, this is where he did it, the very same place. And for me, it was like walking in a museum. It was fantastic. I loved it. Okay. I get a real charge going in there. I still go in and do the morning shows just to hang out in the building.
Yeah, for sure. I was talking, now, did you, when you did Red Green, were you doing it at the old studio by Victoria Park, or were you doing
it? No, we did the one on Hunter. Yeah,
okay.
Victoria Park was all closed up by then. And then they reopened. I think Second City did a show in there, Second City Live, and they re-upped the whole place, and then it closed down again. I guess it's a theater now.
Yeah, it is a theater right now. But I remember you said party gaming. Wow, what a flashback that brought. I was just...
Well, I live in Mount Forest now, and Diana Christie lives up there.
Oh, okay.
From party game, you know, so it's one of those, it's like wherever I go, I take a little Hamilton with me.
Exactly. There's a retro TV podcast that I also do, and we were just talking about Don Heron the other week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he did Red Green there for in the last couple of years, and yeah. I got to know him pretty well. And what a great guy.
Oh, yeah.
He was terrific. You know, just the... He was of a time, you know, and it was just to be in Canada at that time, you get to be in the forefront. That's a nice thing about this industry. You bump into people that you grew up like I can actually say Gordon Pinsent's a friend now. And same thing. He grew up in a time in Canada that created the CBC and created all this stuff that I'm able to do now. You know, there's a few of those warriors that are still around that you really got to say thank you to.
For sure. Now, I always go to the gospel, the internet gospels of Wikipedia and IMDb. Accepting the fact that they may not be completely accurate.
Yes.
Usually the inaccuracies are just that they don't include everything necessarily.
I think Wikipedia says I'm from Saskatoon.
Oh, does it?
One of them did, yeah.
Okay, well, okay. The one I have here says you're in Hamilton, so that's okay. You pretty much for a lot of years just ran the gamut of a whole bunch of shows. Now, this was all while you were doing Red Green, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, I did Red because Green for 15 years.
Yeah, I'm looking at a long list of shows that you were on. Mm-hmm. And so the shooting schedule of Red Green had to be short enough that you could jump onto other series, because it looked like you were series regular on quite a few of these as well.
Yeah, particularly Traitors that time, because I did Traitors for 5 years at the same time I was doing Red Green. Right. So that would be a Monday and Tuesday would be Traitors. Wednesday was Red Green. Thursday, Friday was Traitors. Saturday was Red Green. Sunday was learn lines and start over again. Did that for 5 years. That was exhausting. Because Red Green is such a physically demanding show.
Right.
And you have to be off script. And we had like 50 pages of script to know. So you would be, you know, really, really humping it to, because with comedy, you don't want to be doing the jokes a couple times.
Right.
So, and Steve was pretty strict about having, you know your lines and know your setups and punchlines. And, you know, we didn't go off script very much at all, ever, really. Right. He didn't appreciate that. So you really had to be prepared. And it was a great challenge and a great opportunity because of that. Then I got to suddenly you're getting a phone call from the Due South people and this and that. And you go, oh, yeah, okay. Well, you know, I got a week off here because I'm not in Trader script next week, so I can do Due South then. And it really was a crazy, crazy time. But, there's certain times in your career where you go, this is my window of opportunity. If I'm going to get my foot in and meet these people, this is the way it goes. Because Red Green opened so many doors for me. It was incredible. And slammed others shut, you know. So you never, you just got to run when you can.
Now, it seemed to me, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but Steve Smith seemed to be, because of the length of Red Green, he seemed to be one of the last, it was a very, it seemed like an old school scripted comedy. Like, yeah. I mean, nowadays, and all the great things that went with it and all of the challenges that went with it, like a couple that you just said, like remaining true to the joke and not necessarily feeling as free to go on. But that's a style that we're not, you know, you're seeing less and less now.
Oh, yeah. And even while we were making it, Steve was really aware of that, you know, we were at the end of an era and it was going to be a very small audience who kind of got us. It had to be people who grew up with that kind of TV. You know, because we started before internet and that kind of boom, right? Yeah. So there was a different audience out there. But he would look at me when we'd be doing work and he goes, you know, I'm older than you. I'm fine, but you're screwed. When this is over, nothing going to be ever like this again. And you kind of, you know, you're in the middle of a ride. So you're just going, yeah, whatever, man. It's good now. So let's go. But he was so right. He was dead on. Steve's great that way where he has a great vision of looking about 5-7 years ahead for those type of things. He was always, I mean, that's why we lasted so long, you know.
Well, 50, you can watch the last years. Show. Like,
yeah.
That's staggering.
Oh, it's amazing. And being like I said, in Canada, you never know that you're coming back next year. Yeah. So it was 15 years of, do I buy or rent? You know, it's like, right. you just didn't know. And you'd get like, because of CBC and hockey and things like that, it's like, well, next year you have 9 shows. And then the year after that, you'd have 16 shows. And you have 22 shows. And everything was based around specials and stuff like that. It was a very tight, tight schedule. But, you know, out of it comes a movie and all the rest of it. And Steve's touring the, you know, North America now doing a one-man show and selling out Rama in 15 minutes, you know. Like, it's incredible industry that he's created. It's fantastic. And he was such a great guy to be around because, truly, of all the people that I've met in my life, he's the funniest man I've ever met.
Right.
Line to line, witty, smart. He's just a great guy to hang around. It made it so easy. And, you know, he was from Hamilton, so it was like, we're going to be shooting downtown? How easy does this get?
We're shooting two blocks that way.
Oh, it was just, you know, you kind of, every now and then, you, when life kind of lines up like that, you just shake your head going, wow, this is great. Yeah. This, okay.
Am I correct in thinking that the show really hit a kind of a second boom when it got picked up in the States on PBS?
Oh, that made it. That made all the difference in the world, yeah. Because we got canceled off every network we were on in Canada. Like, we just got canceled off every one of them. You know, we were on YTV there for a little while. Just everything was, you know, no one would stand by us. And then suddenly, you know, the inferiority complex of Canada, the minute Americans started saying we were interesting, away we went. You know, CBC suddenly went, well, let's take another look at this show. And but it was at a time, too, you know, where even they weren't too interested in us, but Air Farce was number one on CBC. And they went into the people there and said, you know, this red-green show would be a perfect lead-in for us. That's our audience.
Right.
And they weren't into it at all. But it was the Air Farce people who said, no, no, let's get this on before us. And that's how we got there. And then you had to hold your own. And, you know, the show was doing great. It was bringing over $1 million a week. And I think it ended up around 700,000 consistently a week, which for CBC is huge.
Right.
You know, it was really weird how things happen, you know. And, but you need people in Canada to champion you. There's no way you can. It's not a Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal kind of show.
Right.
And it was the same in the States. It's not New York, L.A., Chicago. It's all the little towns in between.
Yeah.
And it reminded the networks
the
that there's an audience.
States, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And they don't get a lot of the downtown jokes. It's not for them, you know. So Red Green was perfect. It was, you know, it was Andy Griffith, that kind of audience. It just went, yeah, that speaks to us.
To me, it would be like if Garrison Keillor decided to write a comedy show.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much.
You know.
Very much. And that was really the tone that we had to respect, you know, because you could watch the last episode and the first episode and you wouldn't know they were done too far apart.
Right.
The humor stayed the same. The characters pretty much stayed the same. It was like there was a recipe there, you know.
Now, I have to tell me if I'm wrong here, but the best character name I see down for you on your entire IMDb page, how can you not at some point resurrect the character of Humberto Ortega?
You know, I knew you were going to say that one. That's weird. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Humberto Ortega. Patrick McKenna playing Humberto Ortega.
Yeah, yeah. You know what the weird thing was?
That's range, sir. That's range.
It was one of those comedy episodes they were doing back in the 90s about reality shows, and we were executing people live on TV,
yeah.
And I was sort of Geraldo Rivera type guy. You know, but we're not that far from that now.
No,
you know,
no.
It's catching up. It kills me.
No.
Yeah. I think I did two episodes as Humberto Ortega.
You're listed down here for like a whole bunch of them, but I don't know if they just cut it up differently. Maybe you only shot a couple of days for them, but wow.
Usually, yeah, that's a nice thing when, like right now, I'm kind of into that guest star thing.
Yeah.
So really, you go in for 2 days on a show. Yeah. That's about all, 2-3 days, and then you're off. So I was able to do a lot of those, you know. And back then, too, there was way more choices to do. You could really just pop over and do Due South and then Tech War and then RoboCop. And everything was just happening there all the time. And then something just changed in Canada. We weren't doing as much, you know. So it's great now. And the same people I grew up with are now producers in that who are making Murdoch Mysteries and all these other shows that you get to drop in. Little Mosque in the Prairie, you get a phone call like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll come out to Winnipeg. And Less Than Kind, you go, yeah, great.
Is it the life of an actor in Canada necessarily that, in addition to going out and doing a part here and a part here and a part here, if you don't happen to be locked into a long-term series or, say, a 26 or a 22-episode series, that in addition to doing all of these parts, you're also trying to do development stuff as well?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, for me anyway, I mean, I know other actors who aren't like that at all. They'll go do theater and things like that. But I just, you know, I'm ADHD. I just don't have patience for theater. It's like, I did it last night. I got to do it again. You know, it's like, it doesn't work for me.
You're the third actor I've talked to who said exactly that. I think I was talking with Peter Callahan, and he goes, I don't want, if I do it perfect one night, I don't want to have to do it again the next night.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And Pete's a great pal of mine. I think TV can do that to you because there's that immediate gratification of shooting in front of a live audience that just you get in theater as well. And then you just get to move on. And it's, you know, and you don't get to repeat things very often. So it's not in our wheelhouse to do that. I did a play here in Toronto, and it's like, it was excruciating. you know, whether you got to do a great play or a bad play, you got to work hard 8 shows a week.
Right.
You know, it's a tough slog. So you find things like developing shows and writing shows and trying to produce things and, you know, I direct here and there. So you keep in the industry as much as you can. You know, that's the reason I got into stand-up comedy for 5 years was I wasn't working when I was a young man. I was like, well, I got to get out there and keep dancing. So you do that. And then Second City came along and you do Second City for a few more years. And that leads to something else. And that led to TV and TV led to movies. And, you know, each one is you keep your tool belt full. So you can just kind of go, what do you need me to do?
Yeah.
I don't mind whether it's a lead or supporting. That's really not an issue for me anymore. It's sort of just, you know, keep me working, keep me laughing. I'm all good.
Well, do you find that there's the strong tie? And it seems like this to me. There's a stronger tie now. A lot of people there's more and more actors who are coming out of either they've come out of sketch or they've gone back to get sketch because that intrinsic need, that the realization that over the course of your career now, you might not just be playing a different character each year or every couple of years, that you might be playing 10 to 12 different characters on different shows every single season.
Hopefully that would be nice. Yeah, a lot of people are going back to sketch, particularly in the Toronto area, because it's boomed again. Yeah. It went away for a long time, but now it's back, you know? And it's like Robin Duke from Saturday Night Live has got a thing going here in Toronto once a month, you know? So you can drop in and play with some fantastic people.
Right.
And what I'm working with, like I do this other show, Remedy, and it's a much tighter scripted show. And because of my improv background, I just approach the script so much differently than the other actors. Not in a good or bad way, just completely different. And it really works because I can just kind of breathe life into any moment.
Right.
And because you're making all these different choices that improv teaches you. And then I also have the ability because of the experiences to harness it enough for TV that it will work, you know? And I find that sometimes the best people I work with are the ones from Second City background, because you kind of know when to push and know when to play and know when to do this. And for me, it's been a really nice opportunity that, Canada has taught me. And I think that's why Americans, when they start shooting up here, they're just floored by all the Canadian talent because of the disciplines we have to have. We're ready to go when you need us.
How much of the performance for you when you get up in front of a camera now is still performance? In other words, when the red light comes on and everyone's standing around, do you find yourself in your head you're performing for the camera, in your head you're performing for the people around, or in your head you're just you've gotten to the point where, because sketch, that discipline that you started and grew up in, is very much different from, you know, quote unquote, making love to the camera, let's say.
Mm-hmm. That's been a learning curve consistently for me. And you know, I'll say to a director, because I'm older now, and so I'm meeting a lot of directors who grew up watching me on TV, so they give you that status of, oh, you're that guy. But my first line is, give me all the notes in the world, help me, guide me, direct me, you know, because every time is a new opportunity. And sometimes in your mind, you think you're doing having a great day at work, and everyone else is kind of going, man, you're really sucking today, pal. You know, you're doing sketch, and we're doing an intimate film here. Slow it down, bring it down, you know, all those type of things where you really got to work the discipline of how close is this camera? Is it film? Is it TV? Is it bright? Is it sun? You know, all those different climates of television versus theater. And again, because I've been able to do them all, I'm pretty comfortable wherever I have to be. I'll kind of bring up to speed. So like you say, the stuff that I'm doing in Hard Rock Medical this season is way different than most things I've ever done in television. And as we go into the series, you'll see that my character just falls lower and lower and lower into this mental illness. That's an interesting journey. And you go, oh, this is cool. I don't get to play this very often.
Sure.
That's a nice opportunity.
Is it having an opportunity like that? It sounds like you've run the gamut of pretty much a wide continuum of characters. Is there a type of character that you want to play that you haven't been able to play yet?
Not really, you know, because I've been offered pretty much maybe a cowboy. That'd be about the only thing. You know, we don't do westerns, and we're like, I'd love to do a western. But
Do you want to do Clint Eastwood cowboy, or do you want to do like comedy cowboy?
No, I'm more of a Clint Eastwood cowboy. I'd like to do like a cowboy would be fun.
Yeah,
because I've had opportunities to play like I don't like to play pedophiles and people like that. It's like I've had a lot of opportunities to be with them. That'd be really interesting to see you do that role.
Like, yeah. I'm just thinking if you twist that sentence around and said, I really like to play pedophiles. That's questionable now. I don't know what
exactly
to do with
that. Yeah, well, you said you could edit stuff out, right?
Yes, exactly.
But you do get that because people want you to play against type. But for me, that's not interesting. I don't want to go there as an actor in my mind. I don't want to, because you, as an actor, you have to justify the character. You know, no one thinks they're evil and all those type of things. Yeah. I don't want to have to go there and ever have to justify that in my mind. It's, to me, at the end of the day, it's a TV show that people will flick around and go to something else. It's quite disposable. I'm not saving lives. I'm just trying to entertain.
Right.
So that doesn't entertain me, and I don't like that kind of stuff. So there's been all kinds of opportunities I've had that I pick and choose the ones I want to experiment with. Like last year, I got the chance to do like the lead in romantic comedy.
Right.
And I'm 54 now. That's not going to come by again. You know, so it's like, yeah, I want to play that. I want the Tom Hanks role on this. I want to try that. I want to carry the film. I want to be able to do that. And then sometimes you go, yeah, I'm going to play like an Irish villain in an upcoming film up north. It's like, yeah, I want to do that. I can, a real scary, mean, vicious Irish villain. I'd like to try that too. You know, it's more gangster than it is, you know, emotionally terrifying.
Sure. Are you at the point right now where, like you just said, that you got to play a character that you might not get a chance to play again? Does that somehow, you know, toss around the back of your mind? It's like, where is the range coming now where I'm running out of time to play that kind of guy?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it's, you know, and it never really changes because sometimes you're too young for parts, and then you're right in that wheelhouse, you know. And I think the nice thing, I was talking about timing earlier. Of that sort of, you're ready when the timing is. When you looked at my resume in there, and there's like all those really big shows were going on like 98, I was mid-30s. So you could play early 30s and you could play early 40s. So suddenly you could be a dad, or you can just be a business guy. You could, yeah, be a politician, you'd be a sales. It's a nice range in there that the opportunities are more. You don't ever want to get carried away thinking that you're too special. It's the opportunities are there. And I knew they would be changing. So I, you know, suddenly I'm playing more politicians,
right?
Because you're getting a little more older, a little more stately. Going, okay, this is where I'm at in this point of my career. And I remember watching people like Don Heron and them that were just that much ahead of me. You're going, what roles are they choosing now? How do I believe them? You know, I don't want to ever pretend that I'm going to be like a sex symbol in a show. I was never that to begin with. But as you get older, it's like that's not part of it. Now you're the sex symbol's dad,
right?
You know, that kind of thing. It's like, well, that's good. The roles change. You know, suddenly it's not about the dad usually. So TV is very, it's about a young person's environment, that's who's watching. That's who they're hiring. It's like, okay, well, I'll try and be an interesting dad for that. Or I'll be, you know, a politician with a little bite here. That'd be nice. So that's why I'm finding I'm doing far more film now than television. But when Hard Rock came along and they said the character is going to be, he's an ADHD doctor up north. It's kind of like, you know, that sounds fun. That sounds like there's going to be lots of opportunity to bounce around a bit, you know. It's not going to be the same every week.
For sure. Now, when you're, so getting back to your character on Hard Rock, when you're, where is the creative, I'll talk from the position of being not only a podcaster, but being a musician, being a whole bunch of things in life. At some point, there's a part of the process that I consider to be the creative part of my process, where I really get my yah-yahs out, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
What part of the process is that for you? Is it in building the character? Is it when the camera light goes on? Is it in the research that you do, or just the headspace that you get into to kind of come up with what you're going to do?
By the end of it, it's probably when you're actually on the dance floor and the red light turns on.
Okay.
Because then everything else you've been thinking is theory, and now it starts. And the minute you put it out there, that's the character. And from then on, you have to justify what you did that first day and build on it. And so you got to make sure that you're ready that first day when that red light does go on, because that's what you're going to have to live or die by. So you want to, you know, just either pull back a bit so you got room to go. But if you put it all out, you know, you can bounce around a little bit, but that's the moment. But I'm always excited when I read the script, because everything is potential then.
Right.
You know, like when you get a rhythm in your head, you kind of go, oh yeah, I could play it this way, I could play that. But you don't know what the other characters are going to do. You know, so you look at it and you kind of go, well, my function in the story is to just tell the exposition. You know, I'm not the guy with the shirt off, and I'm not going to be in the fist fight. I'm the exposition guy. So I got to respect my function in the story.
Sure.
And not, you know, you got to be part of the band without stealing the moment.
Sure.
But every now and then it's like, and now it's your solo. Okay, here we go.
Yep.
Then I'll pass it back off to someone else. So you just kind of, that's what I like to see is, where do I do? What's my responsibility? And now how much can I do with this without ruining it? You know, like really just have a lot of fun, you know, add some of this, add some of that, pull back, you know, share, give, pull. It's always fun when you kind of get that feeling of I'm working here. I'm listening and I'm engaged in this, you know, and especially now that I'm working with Enrico Colantoni on another series, he's such a good actor that you know, it's really, you know, it's like any sport or music at all. You get better when you play with better people.
For sure.
Who have different experiences and so on. And he just comes from a different background than I do that I'm just learning so much being with him. And same with all the young people on Hard Rock, that they come from, they've been out of theater school and this and that. I never went to theater school. I don't know any of the stuff they're talking about when they're doing theater games and exercises. I don't know what the hell they're talking about, but it's, you know, it's kind of like, oh, okay, listening. That's what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I listen. All right, I get you.
When does the yes and part come up?
Yeah. Yeah, that's because Second City did teach me so much, right? And that's where that for the listeners, that's where that really comes from, is that yes and from improv background. So watching a lot of things that they know that organically I know, that I don't know the name of the label of it, but I'll just organically know that stuff, because just growing up in Second City, you learned always move forward, always play the action, not the words, you know, and it's there's so many great things that you just pick up through osmosis.
Have you noticed from season one to season two of Hard Rock Medical that the writers, knowing that you're doing the character now, that they saw your performance in season one, that I don't know if you've been given an indication of it or you've just picked it up maybe just kind of subliminally, that they thought, so Patrick's doing that role. This is now how the evolution of this character has to go, as opposed to any other actor that might have been doing that role.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, that I was taken aside and talked to about that, because I wasn't supposed to be in the show quite as much, because again, it's about the students. But the opportunity came of, well, they're going to focus on mental illness. And the Steph Paquette character of Charlie is sort of the early version of my character, where what the doctor was when I was younger. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of shadowing people. So we kind of see, if Charlie's not careful, this is the road he could be taking, is the dangers that I'm falling into this season.
Right.
So it gets to be that, you know, you're kind of mirroring that, set that up, and you can handle... It was a compliment that they said, you can handle, we're going to go very dark, we're going to go very deep, and we think, you know, it'd be fun to watch you do that if you're up to it. Because the time, it was all about, you know, scheduling and things like that too. It was like, yeah, I think that would work. So that became, all right, we'll put you in the forest for 4 days by yourself, you know. It was like, oh, okay, great. We were shooting like 45 pages a day, and it was just me, you know, so it was exhausting but fantastic.
So you didn't go all method and go spend 4 days out in the forest beforehand?
No. And that's a nice thing too about a show like that. The method is the fact that you are up in the woods, standing there in your underwear, and in freezing cold weather. You know, you don't have to do a lot of method. It'll be there.
I usually wrap up the episodes by getting a bit of my retro pop culture nerd on by asking people. I know that all the stuff that I absorbed when I was growing up in terms of television, movies, music, all of that stuff, still frames a whole bunch of the way I think about things today. I'm curious, what are some of the cultural touchstones that when you were growing up, like television shows that were important to you and films that were important to you and music that was important to you, that the stuff that you still carry with you today and think like that's become the canon of the stuff I still go back to?
Oh, that's really easy. Dick Van Dyke, for sure. Yeah. Elvis Presley, because that's just, Elvis.
Both Elvises?
How do you mean both?
Like the young Elvis and then Vegas Elvis?
Yeah, I'll draw on different parts of it. But Elvis was a huge thing for me growing up. Again, you know, when I look back on it, with my ADHD, it was a music that allowed me to move.
Right.
That wasn't music being played around our house much. We had country and western and stuff like that, you know. So when that was played, it was like, oh, look at me, I'm bouncing, I'm moving. It really spoke to me and kind of brought me out of my shell.
Right.
So I always kind of follow that. He was sort of my Superman, you know.
Sure.
Like, wow, everybody really likes him. And so Elvis was my Superman. So I kind of go for that. There's times I go, you know, you got to be this, you got to be that, or I'll play a song in my head and kind of get a rhythm of how I want to walk across the scene or through it. I use a lot of Elvis music in my head to kind of set me up for scenes.
If you ever had to think of the word swagger,
that's it exactly, right? And sometimes because I physically resemble nothing to it, it's an interesting contrast that there's this guy who doesn't look like he should have a swagger has a swagger.
Right.
And that's, you know, if you pick the right song, it really works. Jerry Lewis was huge for me, and Don Knotts, you know, for the Harold stuff and Red Green.
Right.
you know, the Martin and Lewis touchstone of Steve and I was very, very important to those rhythms. Things I just grew up with were kind of part of me, you know, that I just knew real quick of it seemed to work. People responded to it. But those Dick Van Dyke, Jerry Lewis, and Elvis would probably be the touchstones that I always go to.
Right. And it would seem that a good Mount Rushmore, so to speak, of comedy that you look back at in forming a lot of what you do, because you've picked people that, in as much as there's lightness, there's talent, there's comedy, there's when you talked about Elvis, all that stuff. But you also had, with almost all of them, there's that element of tragedy to all of them, because you know them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's how, when people say, "Oh, wow, you can do drama as well," that's a part of it, because each one of them was able to find a moment when they could switch gears. You know, particularly Jerry Lewis was like that. Sometimes he get over the top, but he always found pathos in the moment. And I remember as a kid going, you know, as a kid, you go, "Oh, that was so tender. He's talking to the rabbit." You know, but it was like he was able to turn that. He wasn't always goofy. And I found Harold was able to do that, like to find in Red Green, to find that sympathy where you can make an audience go, "Oh," because the vulnerability of the character. I was 30 when I started that, you know, so I was 45 when I ended. And to still hear an audience go, "Oh," after 15 years, you go, "This is nice. This is a good character. People like Harold. They want to be on his side." So, you know, you've created kind of a you know, the coolest thing for me ever was a Halloween where kids came to the door dressed up like my character. They had no idea I was the guy, but you realize that, you know, hey, I'm on TV, and they're kind of playing us back now. They're watching Jerry Lewis and they liked it. It was neat that the things like that actually were reaching out and touching people, because you just make it in a small box and then it goes out there. You know how people respond to it, but it was really great the way you're going, "Oh, this is working." It's a nice pat on the back sometimes, things like that.
That's almost like a 50s band hearing their record played on the radio for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's exciting, because as a kid growing up in Hamilton, you don't ever think you're going to be any kind of success at anything like that. You don't have any idea. You just kind of go at it. So when years later, and you're able to look back into your life and you go, "Everything I have in my life is because I make people laugh. I'm really comfortable with that." You know, it's a good life when you can do that.
Thanks to Patrick McKenna for joining me here at the TV ABC's podcast. You are listening to TV ABC's either at the tv-eh.com website, or you've already subscribed to the feed for the podcast, which is very cool. We appreciate if you listen to every single episode, because maybe you just dig us talking about Canadian television. If you would like to contribute a little bit of money, value for your listening time, please feel free to go visit our Patreon page. You'll find the link at the website. And even if you wanted to kick in like $1 an episode or whatever you wanted to kick, that would be most appreciated. Helps us defer some of the costs of putting all this stuff together for the website and for the podcast. But even if you don't, you're still welcome to listen for free as long as you want to. My name is Anthony Marco. You can listen to all of my other podcasts at anthonymarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. You can find the TVA Twitter account at TV_EH. And as I said, TV-EH.com is where you can follow all of the stuff that we talk about on a regular basis. Every second week, Diane, myself, and Greg David get together and talk about the business side and the more fan side of television in Canada. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.